You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of Citizen Chambers by Dan Adler. When Barbara Cox died in 2007, most of the rest of the company was wrapped up in Ann's estate. As Ann entered her 90s, Chambers said, his family started to get freaked out about estate planning. In 2013, she won approval from a Georgia court to dissolve the trust established by her father in 1941 that held her company shares, splitting it between family members and charities. A Cox spokesperson described this at the time as a maneuver related solely to the Cox family's goal of maintaining future ownership and control of Cox Enterprises. One upshot, Chambers said, was that he started to get more money faster and through a grantor retained annuity trust, a financial instrument used to minimize estate taxes. His assets accumulated to more than $5 million, and he ramped up his political funding and held organizing meetings at his gym. In the coming years, he brought supplies and trucks to the protest at the Standing Rock Reservation, where he said he saw everything that we recognize in America, what it was built on, and who we took it from, and how we did it, and how we do everything as a nation. In 2017, he bought 90 acres of land in Georgia. He and Park were joined by a man from the reservation, as well as another couple they met there. The Georgia group eventually came to include 14 people trying to grow food and hold retreats on 350 acres. But the project never took full flight. Too many anarchists, Chambers said. No party leadership. By then, he had come to see that income wouldn't be an issue. His media profile began to rise. He made the local news in August 2017 when one of his gyms banned police and active military members. Chambers told an NBC affiliate that he didn't want a heterojock space. When tabloids picked up the story, they usually described him as a lifelong activist. It took Bearing Arms, a news site for Second Amendment enthusiasts, to make the Cox connection by following a trail of Reddit comments. Park was pulled over for drunk driving and resisted arrest. When she received a 40-day sentence in a courtroom in February 2019, Chambers said the entire Morgan County Sheriff's Department was there to stand up and stare him down. According to another person in the room, the police presence was unremarkable, and Chambers began yelling at the judge. Chambers and Park were already thinking about leaving Georgia, and Massachusetts had legalized marijuana in 2016. They wanted a fresh start. Chambers bought a house in the Berkshires and resolved that, when he started over with a land project, he would do so in a more principled way. Chambers grew weed and got into martial arts very seriously. One day, he said, 5 years after they married, he got back from the gym and Park was gone. Chambers was 35 and panicking. While he was in Las Vegas in early 2020 for his birthday and a Conor McGregor UFC bout, his dad called. His grandmother was 100 years old and dying. He flew to Atlanta to sit at her feet. Ann's death briefly brought him closer to Jim. They smoked weed together for the first time and went to the NBA All-Star game in Chicago. Chambers went to New York. He hadn't wanted to be there much since he was a teenager, but he intended to make music with a cousin and slay Tinder to cope. One day, he met Park at St. Ambrose in the West Village for lunch. During their meal, Chambers looked across the restaurant and spotted his old classmate, Stella Schnabel. "It's Fergie from St. Anne's," Chambers reminded her. Schnabel came over to his table and looked him and Park over. This was his wife, he explained, because they weren't yet legally divorced. Schnabel had heard he had lots of kids. Schnabel's father was nominated for an Oscar, and her mother opened an Azadine Alaya boutique in Soho. "There's no downside to being a Schnabel," her brother Vito, an art dealer, once told the New York Observer. In her senior year of high school, Stella began dating Red Hot Chili Peppers guitarist John Frusciante, and Julian made the art for the band's next album, a portrait of his daughter. She had been an actor and poet in the past. Now she had a store at her house in Brooklyn. She invited Chambers to see it, and they exchanged numbers. "I hope you like those truffles," Chambers remembered her texting after she left. "Find me someone to have a baby with." "Immediately my thought is, well, that's going to be me," he said. A little while later, they had dinner and slept together. He needed to go plant weed the next day, so she joined him in Massachusetts, where they had dinner with his mother. The coronavirus pandemic loomed, ending Chambers' plan to go to Thailand for a Muay Thai training camp. He and Schnabel quarantined together. He wanted a real Marxist-Leninist organization on the land, which he would call the Berkshire Communist, and a place where like-minded people from New York and Boston could gather, study, eat, and garden. Chambers inherited around $7 million when Anne died, and between that and his investment dividends, he placed his assets at the time near $10 million. He started a gym program in his garage and paid a top-tier UFC coach to teach free classes for those who were down to tolerate communist politics. Chambers and Schnabel were on and off from the beginning. "We are such bratty kids," he said. "We love each other so much, but it's been really fiery sometimes." They had been apart a few months when he returned to New York to join the protest following the murder of George Floyd. But she drove in from the Hamptons to pick him up when he was arrested. They headed back to Massachusetts, and he said they took San Pedro cactus as they sat by a bonfire. They decided to have a child. One Thursday night last fall, I met Chambers during one of his occasional trips back to New York. We walked a few blocks from the Bowery Hotel in the East Village, where he and Schnabel usually stay. It's owned by Eric Good, a friend of Schnabel's and the brother of Chambers' godfather, from whom Chambers has been estranged. The streets were crowded with bar hoppers and bankers returning home from work. We passed a group of cops standing on the sidewalk, and Chambers began oinking and spit on the ground in their direction. "Yeah, you too," one of the officers said. "I F you," Chambers replied as we continued to walk. "F you, MF. Come back, dumbass." Chambers turned around, and the two men brought their faces within inches. A few outdoor diners were starting to look on. "You spat at me almost." "I didn't spit at you," Chambers countered. "Keep on walking," the cop said. Chambers called him Fat Boy and said he wasn't afraid. Another officer encouraged me to remove my friend from the situation. Chambers walked away on his own. "The whole effing city hates all you MFs," he shouted as he backpedaled. "Your day is coming. Your day is coming." "I'm not stupid," he said as we continued down the street. "That's the thing. I'll play within the boundaries of what you can F around with." But he also felt some sense of duty to make use of his impunity, since there are a lot of people that wish they could do that. He looked up at the football game playing on a television inside a bar we were passing. "Man, they're getting smoked. I'm a Giants fan." Wearing a Fila polo, a flat-brimmed trucker hat, and a dangling boxing glove charm from his ear, he seemed a bit haggard but comfortable. Chambers didn't like the city anymore. Same effing played-out story as everybody else. It ain't what it used to be. And usually came to town only because of Schnabel, though he didn't mind having her mother watch their 2.5-year-old son. On this occasion, he was eager to be here. Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel was in New York for the United Nations General Assembly, and Chambers planned to see him speak at an anti-imperialist summit at Cooper Union. A few of Chambers' comrades, as he referred to them, had also told him about a reception later. Schnabel, like her grandparents and her stepmother and all her siblings and half-siblings, had a small part in her father's 2000 movie, Before Night Falls, an adaptation of the Fidel Castro critic Reinaldo Arenas' memoir, which made Chambers all the more excited to bring her to meet the delegation. We passed through a small area of the neighborhood, sometimes known as Ukrainian Village, and Chambers muttered to himself after seeing a sign objecting to Russia's invasion. Between slices at a nearby pizzeria, he slapped a sticker saying, "Let Cuba live," onto the collection on the wall. As Chambers ate, he continued tracing through his line of thinking on this and related issues, stopping only to get cash from an ATM after we left to go to a bar. "Cuba," he said, "is struggling in some of the same ways the U.S. induced Venezuela and Iraq to struggle. It's immaterial to distinguish between any member of NATO and affiliated countries, all vassals of the United States in some way. With so many people having nothing to lose, some of the conditions for revolution are in place to advance the interest of the global working class. But it would require an organized and centralized party formation, a cadre of professionals, to develop the strategy. He could fund some of the necessary political education." He didn't want to fall into the trope of a rich kid searching for his voice, and he had to let go of notions of personal redemption. But he did come to realize that the only way that I can sort of save my soul was through a focus on collective struggle. "Look, there's probably a lot of effing rich people that do nothing redeeming whatsoever, but they're very happy," Chambers said, drinking a rum and coke he thought was too weak, but this contradicted his experience. "I've been around some of my family and people in their circle and some people in Stella's circle. A lot of these people are not very happy." After some long gaps in their relationship, Chambers and Schnabel had recently started to coalesce nicely, he said. She was on her way to meet us after seeing the Stephen Sondheim musical Merrily We Roll Along with her St. Anne's classmate Zach Posen, the fashion designer, who once described her as his muse. "He dressed up as the Pope for graduation," Chambers said. "He's a very nice guy, not a politically serious person." He seemed to have come to terms with his girlfriend's world, stressing again that it wasn't really one that he had known prior. "She was the first rich person I've ever been close to. Even Stella's brothers are chill," Chambers said. "Whatever." Still, as he saw it, Schnabel long had some inkling that there was something very effed up about the ideology of the place she came from, even if she wouldn't have known how to articulate that, but she would have put it better than I would. "When I was living here," Schnabel said after she arrived, "I was constantly trying to get out." She was wearing fuchsia snakeskin print pants and a beige coat, and Chambers gleefully relayed what had happened earlier. "I almost got into a physical fight with a cop on the street," he told her. "We were up in each other's face." A couple of days later, passing through the neighborhood again, Chambers posted a selfie wearing a Stalin t-shirt on X, writing, "Greetings, Manhattan's Ukrainian Village. I heard there might be some crop hoarding going on." There were new swaths of observers to note that an heir to the Cox fortune was cheekily commemorating the man-made famine that killed millions in Soviet Ukraine in the 1930s. Chambers had already told me in person that gestures like his police run-in weren't ultimately principled or important, and that he had outgrown thinking of such a skirmish as an accomplishment. He didn't betray much anxiety about this at the time, but he texted the next day to say, "Still embarrassed about the cop, LOL. Growing up, Chambers thought of his father as a radical. He learned early on to hate the police, and they bonded around politics and sports. "I really loved my dad," he said, "and in his 20s, as he dealt with his first divorce or had a bad trip, he called him for help. but he came to resent how Jim's politics never crossed the line of class struggle as his had, and how he softened on his principles while getting tired and old. Jim's new wife, Nabila Khashoggi, was another child of immense wealth and a former actor who once professed her devotion to Scientology to a British tabloid. In 2013, as part of the family's new estate planning strategy, Anne transferred almost all of her 49% share in Cox Enterprises in equal parts to her three children. Jim became a billionaire, and he's the one getting phone calls from Rahm Emanuel, Chambers said. He's the one that has access to the NBA ownership group. Chambers doubted that his father would speak to him again, and he didn't especially want Jim to have a relationship with his kids. I don't know what it was that made me feel confident enough to not really F with really anyone in my family anymore, he said. He wasn't as certain of his mother's attitude toward having a relationship with him, but guessed she would like to maintain one. He wasn't interested. In the fall of 2021, he said, while he and Schnabel were in a protracted fight, and when a friend had recently died, his mother called her on the day of the funeral and told her he was bipolar and needed medication. He wrote to his mother. I sent her the most scathing note, Chambers said. It said something like, I'll see you at my grandmother's funeral, not before or after. Hamilton didn't return request for comment. Reached by text, Schnabel first said Hamilton never called that day or told her that. A few minutes later, she said Hamilton had called her a few days after the funeral. Then she said, I have no comment about his mother. Chambers and Schnabel reunited a few weeks later when he went to the Hamptons for an awful Thanksgiving with her family. They would probably both hate to hear this, Chambers said, but I think my father has plenty in common with someone like Julian. Chambers stayed with Schnabel for a few weeks with her mother and the baby, and they started to work it out. They went to meet her sister in Sicily for Christmas and extended their trip while Chambers tried to figure out what the makeup of the European communist movement looked like just for fun. He was continuing to finance the Massachusetts land project with stipended workers now living on it, but he thought about moving to Long Island to be closer to Schnabel when she wanted to be near her mother. In recent months, Schnabel has become increasingly vocal on Instagram. Her bio reads, anti-racist, anti-fascist, and both she and Chambers have turned their ire toward the classes of New York wealth in which they grew up. There are rumors and jokes among her friends about some sort of cult taking place on the land project, though the reality may be closer to a state of perpetual disorganization. One woman in downtown circles went to work there, but it seemed to end poorly. Schnabel bemoaned evil hoarding bitches on Instagram and wrote that the woman was that stupid you don't know when you miss out on a great opportunity. Schnabel later described her to me as a great friend and a part of the collective who didn't want to stay in the country. Are they still together? A friend of Schnabel's asked me. He's a pathological narcissist. But everyone knows that, the friend went on. Their deeper breakthrough took more observation. I'm a communist. I don't want it. They imagined Chambers boasting. It's his way of letting you know he's got lots of money. To get to Ukraine in 2022, Chambers had to go to Russia first. He called and emailed embassies throughout Europe, with flights already canceled and sanctions underway. He rented a car in Sicily and drove to Tuscany, and then Florence, and then to Moldova and Romania, where he tried to get a visa. After living in St. Petersburg and purchasing an apartment where his first wife's uncle now lives, he had some advantages. His mission was to write the story of the Russian invasion from his perspective. Given his resources and the prevailing Western sentiment, it felt to him like an obligation. A representative for the Luhansk People's Republic's Federation of Trade Unions helped him get press accreditation for the separatist regions, and the consulate in Moldova eventually supplied a visa. He headed to St. Petersburg, Moscow, and then Rostov, close enough to the war that he took a taxi to the Donbas border. Chambers said he saw shelled neighborhoods and a recently bombed market, where he came across the body of an elderly woman on the ground in pieces. The only thing anyone's angry at Putin about there, he claimed, is that he didn't intervene sooner. He believes that the U.S. sending weapons is the largest impediment to peace in the area, and like his former gym employee Green, that the Ukrainian government and military contain significant Nazi elements. Chambers' citizen journalism stint comprised a series of Substack dispatches and a few pieces for left-wing outlets. "I got the story I wanted to get," he said. "I understood what I needed to understand, and it was time to go home." Chambers said he had already told Cox that he would consider being bought out of the company. When the call came, he had been bashing his family members by name for about a month. The negotiations took nearly a year. Under the terms of agreement, he said he couldn't get into all the specifics, but he noted that the $250 million was only a portion of what he'll receive in the next 15 years. The windfall presented a certain predicament. "Well, why didn't you cut yourself off?" Chambers said, mocking the most obvious criticism he's faced. He saw it as a matter of strategy. By holding on to money, his thinking went, you can easily make more money, all the while gathering more information about how to spend it. And the money could be useful soon. Chambers thought our political crisis could develop overnight here. On the advice of a communist friend, Chambers hired a staff. "You need someone to handle your emails," he was told, "and like hire an MF to watch your dogs when you need to leave town." He was now mostly living in New Hampshire, but the land project continued in Massachusetts, where he had bought a marble quarry. He erected a communist library and a state-of-the-art MMA gym. The rubbernecking was getting underway. He didn't want to be put in the zoo as an absurdity, Chambers said, but he thought he had some media savvy and could generate bad press around Cop City. He gave an interview to the New York Post, which pointed out that he had secured an alleged payout more befitting an oligarch than a proletariat. He continued to pop up on social media, mostly as an oddity, until Hamas's attack on Israel on October 7th. Great Barrington is one of the posher weekend destinations in western Massachusetts, a town of roughly 7,000 that Vogue has described as quietly cool and home of the Bard-affiliated liberal arts college, Simon's Rock. Chambers' land in Alford was a few minutes away. The Berkshire Communist marched down Main Street on October 10th, chanting "From the River to the Sea." Chambers told the Berkshire Edge that the Al-Aqsa flood was a powerful statement of resistance to genocide. The paper pulled real estate records, showing the properties belonging to an LLC he owns. About 50 acres for over $5 million spread among six purchases. "We need to start making people who support Israel actually afraid to go out in public," Chambers wrote on Instagram. In November, the Berkshire Eagle published a profile, young, communist, gun owner, multimillionaire, describing his social media utterances as a threat to anyone who supports Israel, and noting that, with Great Barrington residents starting to become frightened, the district attorney's office and police detective unit were on alert. Chambers explained to the Eagle that he didn't personally keep any firearms in Alford, only shotguns on a mountain in New Hampshire, like everybody else, and had no plans to raise a militia or harm anyone. He wrote online that there weren't any guns on his Massachusetts land, beyond a shotgun or two, with lawfully permitted owners. The Free Beacon described Chambers as using Daddy's money to harass Jews, noting that he had been paying legal fees for members of the U.S. branch of Palestine Action, a loose social media-based protest network that has sought to disrupt the work of Israeli weapons suppliers. The Free Press, the online media company founded by Barry Weiss, sent a reporter, her sister, Susie, to New Hampshire to profile Chambers. There are very liberal colleges with very liberal students who want to take the theories they learn in the classroom into the streets, the writer surmised. And then there's Fergie, with hundreds of millions of dollars, eager to make it all go boom. The notion bore little resemblance to the colleges of the Berkshires, but it did faithfully convey the literal content of Chambers' social media output. In October, he and other protesters locked themselves to the door of Israeli defense company Elbit Systems' office in Cambridge. He sent me a voice message explaining how he evaded arrest by hiding in his grandmother's backyard. On a Monday morning the next month, Palestine Action protesters blocked the entrance to Elbit's New Hampshire campus. Some of them went to the roof of the building, where they poured red paint down the facade and set off flares. They smashed windows and locked a lobby door with a bicycle anti-theft device. No one was hurt, and the most immediate reverberation from the day was the arrest of three women between the ages of 19 and 27. They were charged with riot, conspiracy to commit criminal mischief, burglary, and conspiracy to commit falsifying physical evidence, felony charges that are each punishable by 3.5 to 7 years in state prison. New Hampshire's Republican Attorney General, John Formella, announced that he was investigating potential Civil Rights Act violations. Chambers paid $50,000 to bail the women out. A building inspector told the Alford Select Board in December, a year ago, that the facility housing the Berkshire People's Gym was not permitted for commercial use, only agricultural storage and farm equipment, and began sending cease and desist notices. On New Year's Day, the barn was cleared out. The gym is gone, the board chair said at the next meeting. Toward the end of the year, I thought I might not speak with Chambers again. There was a rumor among friends of Schnabel's that the FBI was looking for him, and over text, he seemed tentative about the increasingly suggestive press and social media attention he was receiving. He switched to using an encrypted messaging app. Then one Sunday afternoon, he video called me. He was in Tunisia, though he asked to keep that quiet, wearing a brown kufi and rolling a cigarette in a sleek but not opulent apartment. Between bites of a sandwich, he explained his intentions in his new locale, where Schnabel would arrive the next day. In the first place, they would take Shahada. I realized that I was definitely being too cavalier in some ways, Chambers said, definitely too self-obsessed. He thought that in the last couple of years he had been productive on a political level, but generally scattered, relying too much on weed and training as his personal turmoil mounted. I'm looking over my shoulder everywhere, he said. He was panicking as he left the U.S., but calmed down when he sat on the plane reading the Quran. He began studying Arabic and going to the mosque 5 times a day. That's another thing I know people will want to caricature, Chambers said. I don't really care. In the aftermath of the New Hampshire arrest, he said he generally wanted to keep a lower profile. It feels like my existence is part of why these women are facing years in prison, Chambers said, and I hate that. Tunisia has no extradition treaty with the U.S., and Chambers seemed to play with the idea. Federal agents showed up at Schnabel's home in Long Island, he said, and police called a friend of his in Vermont. No agents showed up at my house in L.I. at all, ever, at any time, Schnabel said, but later texted to say that someone did arrive, possibly PSEG or a plumber. There are people that are facing a lot of really severe stuff right now, he continued, including maybe me, we don't know. A few tweets noting the age and gender dynamics of the Berkshire communist had surfaced following the arrest. People want to make this connection, and they want to effing skewer me, he said. They probably think I'm like a crazy Charles Manson terrorist. By January, Chambers was open about his whereabouts. His profile on X listed his location as Tunis. He and Schnabel married the following month. In March, Chambers was upset about how he had been depicted in a cluster of interviews. Not enough was made, he said, of his distance from drinking and drugs, or the need to connect movements to the global South. People from his past have often seemed conflicted about how interesting or important he is, or how dangerous. The general consensus among St. Anne's classmates was that while they did not specifically expect anything violent to happen with Chambers, they would not be shocked if it did. Chambers said that at times he has contemplated simply disappearing. He ultimately ruled it out. "Is that what's going to happen to me?" he asked himself. "They're going to shut me up?" "I can't have that," he said in Tunisia, leaning back in his chair. When he was a kid, he became accustomed to seeing his father intermittently. He was starting to worry about the same pattern developing with his three older children in Atlanta, and he could see how his relationship to his family had informed his oppositional stance. "Of course, if my father is shitty in a number of ways, then my daddy issues influenced what I do politically," he said. "I guess I just expected they were going to steadily become more pleased with me." People in his position often liked attention, he understood, and perhaps even more than attention, disillusionment. It was unavoidable. "This is what I came from," Chambers said. "There's nothing we can do about that." shots in the dark. The Ozempic weight loss miracle has a dark side, as desperate patients contend with shortages and sky-high prices. A world of criminals and con artists are filling the void with life-threatening counterfeits. Catherine Abin investigates our alarmingly active pharmaceutical underground with illustrations by Sean Martinborough, coloring by Christopher Sotomayor. Opening illustration shows a man with a lab coat walking into a drug holding area with packages in disarray. In early December of last year, James Pinckney II, M.D., stood in a cold warehouse in Elmira, New York, surveying what looked like the deal of the century. Pallets of blue coolers stretched before him, each packed with boxes bearing the logo of Danish drug maker Novo Nordisk, an Egyptian Apis bull representing strength and fertility, balancing the sun between its horns. Until recently, Novo Nordisk was a sleepy century-old insulin manufacturer, but in the past 2 years, its diabetes treatment Ozempic has swept the world. After a clinical trial confirmed that the drug, first approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration in 2017, produces miraculous weight loss, influencers from Elon Musk to Oprah helped popularize it. The drug has brought new hope to those struggling with obesity and made Novo Nordisk Europe's most valuable company, even as it tore open a Pandora's box of human vanity. The frenzy surrounding it has sparked global shortages. Pinckney, an ebullient family medicine doctor married to a former Sports Illustrated swimsuit model, is the founder and CEO of Diamond Health, a concierge medical practice in Dallas. His quest for affordable Ozempic had brought him to the warehouse of F.M. Howell & Company, a mid-sized pharmaceutical distributor founded in 1883. Snapping photos, Pinckney closely examined the shrink-wrapped boxes of Ozempic, each containing a single four-dose pen of injectable semaglutide, the peptide developed by Novo Nordisk that increases the body's insulin production, slows digestion, and decreases appetite. Pinckney left favorably impressed with the potential windfall. Here was a reputable wholesaler with thousands of Ozempic pens at a relatively affordable price. To be safe, Pinckney decided to ask for help vetting the merchandise. He reached out to Dennis Moore, a former California drug investigator who runs a company called Hudson Scientific that facilitates the manufacture and distribution of drugs and medical devices. Moore had been trying and failing for more than a year to become an authorized Novo Nordisk distributor. He'd also had his eye on the Ozempic for sale at F.M. Howell. Following Moore's detailed instructions, Pinckney sent him documentation and photos, then shipped several samples of the Ozempic to a reference laboratory in Minnesota. Upon initial inspection, the product looked good. It bore an authentic lot number, NAR0074, and came with a detailed inventory trail. On December 18th of last year, the Minnesota lab came back with its results. The pen contained the right peptide, semaglutide, for which Novo Nordisk holds the exclusive patent. But there was an oddity. The pens contained more than the specified dose of 1 milligram per injection. Looking closer, Moore and his quality director, Angela Powell, noticed other irregularities. The injection needles looked slightly different, and a small label on each pen was almost imperceptibly askew. Powell realized something was gravely wrong when she scrutinized the boxes in the photos. Each box should have been marked with a unique serial number. But instead, they all had the same one, 430-834-149057. Moore picked up the phone and called Novo Nordisk. 3 days later, on December 21st, The FDA blasted out an alert. Counterfeit Ozempic had been detected in the legitimate drug supply, the agency warned, and no one should sell, distribute, or use any Ozempic pens labeled with lot number NAR0074 and serial number 43083414905-7. This looked like a fast response by FDA standards, but it wasn't fast enough. Thousands of counterfeit Ozempic pens had arrived at F.M. Howell's warehouse in the fall of 2023. Since then, some had been sold. Where had those doses gone? And just as pressing, where had they come from? Pinckney declined to comment for this article, citing the ongoing FDA investigation. In a phone call, Catherine Relke, the CEO of F.M. Howell, said, "We are bound by confidentiality agreements with our customers. Your facts are incorrect," then hung up. An FDA spokesperson said the agency cannot comment further on an ongoing investigation. Under U.S. law, drugs are supposed to travel seamlessly from a manufacturer's loading dock to a distributor's pristine warehouse to a pharmacy shelf through a protected chain of companies that follow strict requirements for handling medications and documenting sales. But while the American drug supply is dominated by three large distributors, it's also teeming with small-time middlemen with state licenses who buy and sell drugs like any other commodity. Sometimes, as they scour the marketplace for bargains, they may buy what are known as diverted drugs, which have been siphoned out of authorized sales channels. Some have been stolen, illegally resold by patients, or improperly hawked out of a pharmacy's back door. The drugs may well be authentic, but they might also be expired, improperly stored, or contaminated. Under FDA rules, diverted drugs are considered adulterated and not fit for human consumption because their safety and quality cannot be guaranteed. Then there are outright counterfeits, drugs that have been criminally altered in some way, diluted, replaced with cheaper ingredients, or relabeled, for example. In America's pharmaceutical gray market, where the origin of drugs can be murky, counterfeiters may take advantage of a shortage by offering desperate pharmacies and wholesalers a bargain that's too good to refuse, especially when it comes with a credible cover story. Wherever you have illegal diversion, you're going to have counterfeits, says C. Todd Ratcliffe, president and CEO of the Pharmaceutical Security Institute, a nonprofit where pharma security directors pool intelligence on emerging threats. The more popular or costly the drug, the bigger the gray market, the more middlemen clamoring for it, and the more criminal opportunity. To figure out where lot NAR0074 counterfeits originated required solving a complex puzzle with pieces potentially strewn all over the globe. The FDA was confronting a vast matrix of possible suspects, including organized crime rings with ties to the governments of foreign nations. All have been learning as they go how to breach America's defenses in order to sell their counterfeit medicine in the most expensive and lucrative market in the world. Ozempic belongs to a class of drugs known as GLP-1 agonist, which were originally developed to control diabetes. The first such drug to be approved by the FDA was developed in the 1990s after a team of Veterans Affairs researchers discovered that Gila monster venom contains a hormone that regulates blood sugar. The drug they helped create, exenatide, a precursor to Ozempic, has been used by millions of diabetes patients over the past two decades. But the weight loss potential of these drugs took center stage only in the past 3 years, after a clinical trial of Ozempic confirmed a surprise benefit. Those taking it could lose as much as 15% of their body weight. Social media and deft marketing by Novo Nordisk did the rest. The new generation of GLP-1 agonists have become household names, chief among them Novo Nordisk, Ozempic, and Wegovy, and Eli Lilly's Mounjaro and Zepbound. While Ozempic and Mounjaro are approved to treat diabetes, in practice, doctors prescribe all four drugs to patients looking to lose weight. And with everyone from obesity patients to never-too-rich or thin celebrities demanding the drugs, they have become a hot commodity among transnational crime groups, homegrown counterfeiters, rogue compounders, shady middlemen, unscrupulous doctors, and medispas of dubious legality. Counterfeiters are like any other businessmen, says Jeffrey Potter, a U.S. brand protection attorney. They wake up every day thinking, how do I expand my business? For counterfeiters, the conditions for commercial growth are perfect. Soaring prices, worldwide shortages, desperate patients, and ever-climbing obesity rates. Back in its pre-semaglutide days, Novo Nordisk enjoyed a relatively serene existence. Headquartered in Bagsværd, Denmark, it has spent years quietly researching how to make insulin that lasts longer in the body. The Novo Nordisk Foundation, which last year awarded $1.3 billion in philanthropic grants and investments, helps fund climate change solutions and other causes. Yes, the company had run-ins with bad guys, like the crew that hijacked one of its insulin trucks in North Carolina in 2009. And it, too, occasionally was accused of being the bad guy. In 2017, the Justice Department alleged in a civil lawsuit that Novo Nordisk failed to warn consumers of the risk of a rare cancer from one of its diabetes medicines, Victoza. The company settled for $58.7 million without acknowledging wrongdoing. But for the most part, the company was not on a war footing. It didn't even have a global product security director until recently. Now, with a veritable Star Wars canteen of international criminals counterfeiting its products, Novo Nordisk has had to get tough fast. In September 2022, it hired its first director of global product security, Anne Devaud, a former French customs superintendent who had been in charge of investigation at Charles de Gaulle Airport outside Paris. My first mandate was to confirm to the management, do we have an issue with counterfeits, Devaud tells Vanity Fair. A few months after, I was able to say, yes, we have an issue. The scale and scope of these counterfeits is daunting. The link with organized crime is increasing, Devaud explains. We can see how that the modus operandi of the counterfeiters is more and more sophisticated. They are well organized. They have the channel to distribute. Novo Nordisk made available for the first time several of its top security and risk management officials to discuss the global proliferation of counterfeit Ozempic, but they declined to discuss any ongoing investigations. Through extensive reporting and interviews with pharmacists, doctors, security experts, law enforcement officials, private investigators, and attorneys, Vanity Fair obtained details of specific counterfeiting incidents around the world. Some counterfeiting schemes are industrial-scale efforts to replicate semaglutide with uneven success. Others are cruder and even more dangerous switcheroos. Many of the patients whose adverse effects have been reported to the FDA have injected insulin that was relabeled to look like Ozempic. Diabetics use insulin to lower their blood sugar. For non-diabetics, accidentally injecting insulin can be worse than life-threatening, says Michael Wall, MD, medical director of the Illinois Poison Center. You can get irreversible brain damage if your glucose is too low for too long. The list of risk goes on. Mystery impurities, improper storage conditions, dirty needles. According to FDA records obtained by Vanity Fair, patients around the world have suffered horrifying consequences, including comas and seizures. One death has been linked to a suspected instance of counterfeit Wegovy. Fake versions of Ozempic have landed in multiple countries, from Lebanon and Serbia to Belgium and the United Kingdom. Between July 2022 and January 2024, the FDA fielded 12 reports of U.S. patients harmed by counterfeit Ozempic, with symptoms ranging from loss of consciousness to swelling of the throat and face. There have also been reports of 9 patients who suffered adverse events related to lot NAR0074, though it's unclear if they used pens from the real lot or the counterfeit batch. Meanwhile, the law enforcement agencies tasked with countering this global threat face a host of intractable obstacles. A key law in the U.S. to better monitor the supply chain is still only partly implemented after more than a decade on the books. International laws range from weak to non-existent. Corrupt governments look the other way at counterfeiting rings if they aren't participants themselves. The good ideas are too late. They don't keep pace with evolving technology, and there's a fractured system of regulatory enforcement, says Libby Bainey, a lawyer specializing in online drug safety and distribution. All these layers of complexity create criminal opportunity. In the U.S., this dysfunction was visible back in the early 2000s, when I spent 3 years in South Florida shadowing pharmacists and cops on the trail of domestic counterfeiters. The book I wrote, Dangerous Doses, prompted domestic reforms, including a pledge by the nation's largest pharmaceutical wholesalers to stop buying from a poorly regulated gray market of middlemen, some of whom were convicted narcotics traffickers. Since that time, however, the counterfeiters have gotten smarter, better, and most importantly, bigger. Where once they operated out of shady neighborhoods, now they're woven into the infrastructure of entire countries. Russian organized crime has moved into the Canadian online pharmacy space. China's government is openly subsidizing companies that illegally buy and sell the ingredients for synthetic fentanyl. And counterfeit versions of cancer drugs, including Keytruda and Avastin, have been traced to Turkey. The relative lack of enforcement in that country is a huge issue and a huge threat, says Tara Stecti, the former director of product integrity at Merck, which manufactures Keytruda. The pallets of counterfeit Ozempic pens in F.M. Howell's warehouse looked good to the untrained eye and had come with a seemingly legitimate sales history. But the boxes had emerged from a pharmaceutical underworld that was primed for the emergence of a miracle drug. A global network of sophisticated counterfeiters, dodgy middlemen, and rank opportunists had each played their part. By now, the culprits and the counterfeits could be anywhere. In the fall of 2023, a young woman in Salzburg, Austria, visited a plastic surgeon who was selling Ozempic pens illegally. Not diabetic and only slightly overweight, she made 4 visits to buy the pens. Each time, the surgeon's price ticked upward as supplies throughout Europe grew scarce. The drug appeared to be working, but when the woman injected the 4th pen, she suffered convulsions and her blood sugar plunged. The counterfeit pen contained insulin, not semaglutide, and the hypoglycemic attack it caused could have been fatal had the woman's boyfriend not rushed her to the hospital. 2 days later, another of the plastic surgeon's patients suffered a similar life-threatening reaction. In a report to the FDA, Novo Nordisk described how another Austrian patient who took counterfeit Ozempic had a seizure for circa 7 minutes, was foaming at the mouth, their eyes were open, and was staring straight ahead. The patient was hyperventilating. European investigators, tracing the origin of the counterfeit pens sold by the plastic surgeon, followed the chain of custody through a web of distributors in Austria, Germany, and the UK, and back to an all-too-familiar home base, Turkey. Specifically, an exporter in Ankara named AUB Healthcare was identified as being a conduit for the counterfeits. Reached by phone, Atis Belier, a foreign trade specialist at the company and the wife of the owner, denied selling counterfeit Ozempic. "Why are we blamed for something we haven't done?" she asked. "We have nothing to do with these baseless claims." She said AUB had provided exonerating information to the Turkish Health Ministry, but did not share it with Vanity Fair. Officials from Turkey's health ministry did not respond to repeated calls or detailed questions. Lately, drug investigators in both the public and private sectors have found themselves increasingly preoccupied with Turkey. "Everything is linking back there right now," says Chris Buckner, a Los Angeles private investigator who works with a number of international drug companies. "Turkey is rampant with diverted product, but recently we've seen a huge spike in counterfeit life-saving drugs." Investigators at the National Intellectual Property Rights Coordination Center, IPR, a task force that steers the U.S. government's anti-counterfeiting efforts from within the Department of Homeland Security, say Turkey is a top priority this year. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.